All right, our last case this morning is 2020-1266, the state of Ohio versus Edward Maddox. For the appellant, Mr. Miley.
Chief Justice O'Connor, and may it please the court, Andy Miley for the appellant, Mr. Maddox. We reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, please. The state of Ohio and its attorney general insist that the General Assembly may enact a sentencing scheme codified within the Ohio Penal Code and immunize that sentencing scheme from facial constitutional attack in any proceeding where the fundamental and constitutional right to counsel attaches. This is not the purpose of the rightness doctrine. And in fact, in its merit brief below, the state never raised the rightness doctrine. That doctrine is a judge-made rule of judicial restraint that promotes judicial economy by barring lawsuits about hypothetical or abstract concerns. But here,
I hear you on the ripeness issue. Was or was not an objection made at trial at the time of sentencing about the constitutionality?
No, but plain error is no, it was not, Your Honor. But that's why in the Court of Appeals, we raised two assignments of error, which would be plain error, which is always preserved, and also ineffective assistance of counsel for not raising that issue. So as I was saying, the state here prosecuted Mr. Maddox. Mr. Maddox did not bring this case. This case was brought to him. And he contends on the merits that the statutes that he's already been sentenced under in this case are invalid and void ab initio. Therefore, his purely legal challenge to the statutes at issue have nothing to do with hypothetical, abstract, or future conduct. Plus, affirming here would drain, not conserve, judicial resources. This is because a felony defendant always retains an automatic right of appeal under Revised Code 2953.02, and in some cases under 08. But according to the panel below, the person may not appeal the constitutionality of the very sentencing scheme they were sentenced under. The panel said that this has to be separately brought in piecemeal litigation, civil habeas corpus litigation, where no right to counsel attaches. And because no right to counsel attaches, most habeas litigation is brought by pro se inmates, and therefore the courts don't benefit from professional advocacy. Beyond this, the certified question actually skips a more fundamental point. That is, when is a facial challenge to the sentencing scheme ripe in the first instance? The answer is at the common pleas court, the trial court, the sentencing level. And that's because if a sentencing scheme is invalid, as we contend here, then the common pleas court judge should not impose sentence under that scheme in the first place. And I want to again be very clear that Maddox merits theory, I know the merits aren't at issue on the certified conflict appeal, but his merits theory does not depend on future happenings. We agree that the government is correct that Revised Code 2967271 is the statute that purports to give the prison department the power to hold an inmate for an additional period of incarceration. But Maddox's theory is that newly enacted 2929.14a2a, which is the minimum sentencing statute, and 2929.144b1, which is the maximum sentencing statute, which they were both enacted at the same time as 2967271. Those two statutes, the minimum statute and the maximum statute, are the first two steps in an overall unconstitutional plan. Therefore, Maddox, in his appeal, was resisting the exaction of the indefinite sentence as the first step in an unauthorized plan. This is analogous to the third supplemental authority that we cited, Beaver Excavating versus Testa, United States v. Butler, where this court in Beaver and the United States Supreme Court in Butler said, when a series of connected statutes are passed at the same time, their validity is not determined in isolation. So the minimum sentence statute and the maximum sentence statute only serve the purpose of enabling the prison department's power, which we think is invalid. So if we're correct about that, so we get to peek through to the validity of 271 to determine the issue at bar, which is the invalidity of 14A2A and 144B1. Now, that doesn't mean
counsel. The conflict cases that are cited, don't they, that we cited, assume that there's ripeness, that the case is ripe for hearing, but never really reach the issue of ripeness? Isn't that correct?
They don't mention ripeness, and I think that is correct, but I think that is appropriate because it's so obviously ripe, there was no need to mention it. So there's a conflict because in certain appellate districts, appellate courts are not opining upon the constitutionality of these interconnected statutes. And in other appellate districts, they are opining upon it. And recently in our fourth and fifth supplemental authority, the 8th District Court of Appeals has found Topes invalid. So
can we parse this between facial and as applied? Because I think you're arguing primarily facial, but then some of the courts that have said it's not ripe for as applied are saying that you have to wait until it's actually applied to extend the incarcerated person's sentence.
Yes, I think a facial attack definitely is ripe at this point in time. And that your question gets to the two factors. We don't think I want to answer this in two ways, Justice Bruner. We don't think the ripeness doctrine applies at all because we are attacking the imposition of the indefinite term itself. We're saying that this scheme is facially invalid, and accordingly, the repeal of the definite sentencing scheme is itself invalid, and we should have been sentenced under the definite sentencing scheme regime that was in place prior to March of 2019. But I think, Justice Bruner, there's two factors. Even if the ripeness doctrine might otherwise apply, which we deny, the courts look at hardship and fitness. So fitness goes to what needs to be developed. Does there need to be a developed record for a court to determine this legal challenge? And for a facial challenge, there's nothing that needs to be developed. It's just a pure legal challenge. And as applied situation maybe it won't be fit because we'll have to see what happens. But there's also the hardship situation, which here there's plain hardship merely because of the right to counsel issue. The state should not be able, if this court affirms, you're essentially saying that the legislature may strip the constitutional right to counsel by legislative fiat by enacting an indefinite sentencing scheme. And
counsel, if your client is incarcerated, which he is, and 4 years pass and he's released from prison.
Yes.
Then he's happy and you're happy.
But that's not really the point of our challenge here. The point is that there was no power to impose an indefinite term in the first place. So he cannot be subject to the coercive effects of the Tokes law because if in fact that law is invalid. And that's the only thing we're asking the court to do in this case is give us a chance to be heard on our facial constitutional attack.
So if he's subject to judicial release or he's subject to post-release control, there still is a concern because if he messes up, he could go back into prison and then he could still be subject to the Tokes law, correct?
That is correct. He would always be, once the sentence is imposed, he would always be subject to the terms of that law. And really, we think that the ripeness of the Tokes law is comes to bear the moment someone is indicted. Because that person has a right to know, hey, what is the sentencing scheme attached to my case valid or not? So that goes to, you know, plea bargaining process. Can the state hold this sword of Damocles over everyone's head in the intervening years until 5 years, 4 years from now, we get a habeas corpus decision? That goes to hardship. Is it a knowingly voluntary plea if we think, hey, my lawyer says that this law is unconstitutional, but the trial court judge and the appellate court is saying that it's not ripe for appeal? So there's all these factors that go into it. Next, I want to point out that in the supplemental authority that we cited, the state, in trial courts in Ohio where the state has lost at the trial court level and the trial court judge did exactly what we're saying, hey, I'm about to sentence this defendant and I need to decide, do I sentence under the Tokes law or not, because the Tokes law may be invalid. And in those cases where the judge invalidated the Tokes law and therefore sentenced under the prior scheme, which is the definite sentencing scheme, What does the state of Ohio do in those cases? They appeal on the merits and say, oh, the finding of unconstitutionality was wrong. So the state has really been inconsistent on how they've approached this issue. They're basically saying,
Counsel, what you're asking us to do is just say this is ripe for review and remand it to the 6th District.
Chief Justice, that's all we're asking in this case. I want to make one more point before I reserve the balance of my time. If this court, that's what we think should be done. However, if this court affirms, then what we would ask you to do is vacate all of the decisions upholding the Tokes Law, because then those would have been issued in violation of the rightness doctrine. The state can't have it both ways. Unless there's any more questions, I reserve the balance of my time.
Okay. All right. And for the state, we're going to start with Ms. Brayman.
Thank you. Good morning, Chief Justice, and may it please the court. My name is Allie Brayman, and I'm here today on behalf of Julia Bates, the prosecutor for Lucas County. I'll be sharing the last 5 minutes of my time today with my colleague from the Attorney General's office, Ms. Bry. The Reagan-Tokes Act creates a presumption that an offender will be released after serving the minimum part of his sentence, but it also allows ODRC to rebut that presumption and keep the offender in prison up to the stated maximum term. The only question before the court today is whether a claim that those provisions of the act are unconstitutional is ripe for review on direct appeal from sentencing. The answer is no. Ripeness is all about timing. And this court has said that a claim is not ripe for review if it rests on contingent events that might never happen.
So counsel, if you fast forward and 4 years pass, and somehow the DRC, which is the decision maker here, right? Not the court, you know, it's a executive branch decision, right?
Correct.
Decides for some reason they're gonna keep them another year, correct? Then you're saying he has to institute a habeas action, correct?
Correct, yes, Your Honor.
All right, and what I've always found problematic with habeas actions is that they take time. And if it is illegitimate that he is being held, all right, then, you know, he is detained, incarcerated illegitimately. What is the recourse then for this defendant if he's spending a year in prison while the legal system addresses his complaint? And they find that that he shouldn't be there. It invalidates the decision of the DRC, finds it to be unconstitutional. What happens to any defendant under those circumstances? Is it just tough luck? You had to go through it. That's all there is to it.
Well, Your Honor, first, I believe there is a process for habeas where it can be filed directly to this court, and they can ask for the review to be expedited. So that's one potential way that the process could be sped up. But if it gets to the point of where this court says that it is unconstitutional, I believe there are procedures to repay that defendant. I believe there are ways that they can receive money for the days that they are spent incarcerated under the invalid sentence. But my argument is—
Don't they have to file a lawsuit for that?
I believe so, but I think that is a potential recourse that they could do at
sure,
that
point. With no counsel provided, just like with habeas, right?
But I think that the court has every discretion to appoint counsel in that position. And I believe that courts would be likely to appoint counsel in that position. And so they would have counsel and then they will be represented during that suit.
That's a statutory remedy. I don't think there's anything in that statute that permits the appointment of counsel. Do you?
I don't have the statute in front of me, and I'm not 100% familiar with that statute. But I think the argument of the likelihood of success down the line is a future concern. The concern right now is whether this issue is ripe for review right now.
So if a judge puts someone on post-release control or says or instructs them that they may be on post-release control for 3 years. Can a defendant can challenge that before he or she's actually been placed on post-release control, right?
I think the defendant can challenge the court's compliance with the post-release control statute, whether the court notifies that it's mandatory or discretionary.
And so why is that different? Why, I mean, that person, if it's a discretionary post-release control, the person may never be on post-release control. So why does that person get to challenge the judge's advisement at sentencing, but a person under Reagan Tokes has to wait until they've actually been given the extra time?
Well, Your Honor, the difference is that in the post-release control example that you just gave, the person is challenging the advisement. Under Reagan Tokes, there are certain advisements that have to be given at the sentencing hearing, but that has nothing to do with the actual execution of what could happen down
the line. Wait a minute, the advisement, you're saying, defendant, you're liable for post-release control, and here's what that's all about. Well, what if they're not liable for post-release control? What happens if the judge made a mistake and they're not, you know, subject to post-release control?
And that's an issue that can be brought on direct appeal, because that is something that is imposed at the sentencing hearing. Post-release control is imposed at that time.
It's imposed, but it's not triggered. It's just like this extra time at the discretion of the DRC is imposed, but it's not triggered.
Exactly. And the constitutional violations that Mr. Maddox is claiming don't happen. They're not triggered until his minimum sentence has been served.
Well, neither is post-release control. That's the point.
But exactly. And there are cases out there, and I believe the State v. McCann case from the 8th District was the one that the 6th District relied on in this case, where the defendant tried to argue that the post-release control statute violated his constitutional right to a jury trial because it provides the parole authority with the authority to send him back to prison if he violates post-release control. And that's exactly what the core concerns here are, is that ODRC has the authority to hold this hearing and determine whether the presumption of release has been rebutted. But he's not subject to that statute right now. It hasn't taken effect. It won't take effect until he serves his minimum term.
But he is subject to the statute.
Correct. But the application of the statute hasn't taken effect. He could be released early. He could be perfect inmate while he's incarcerated, and the conditions necessary to rebut the presumption might never happen. And in that case, ODRC won't even hold the hearing. He'll serve his minimum term and he'll be out. There's no harm. And there has to be some harm for this court or any court to review the issue. And
but if you compare this to post-release control, there's some that is mandatory and some that is really subject to ODRC. I mean, doesn't this just really go back to what scheme you're sentenced under? Because I mean, if there's a requirement of the advisement, then it becomes part of the sentencing scheme. So why treat post-release control one way and the Reagan-Tokes Act another way?
I don't necessarily think that they are treated differently, because these arguments aren't challenging an indefinite sentence. The argument is not that an indefinite sentence itself is unconstitutional. The argument is that giving ODRC this authority to hold this hearing, that's what's unconstitutional. And in the post-release control context, the argument is that giving the parole board the authority to do this down the line is what's unconstitutional. But that hasn't happened yet, and it might never even happen.
But you're saying that it's not ripe in the Reagan Tokes situation, but that challenge, you're saying that there is an argument that DRC should not have the authority for this, but that's not ripe to challenge. Yet you can say under the post-release control challenge, if the challenge is that the parole board is in error to impose this, that is ripe for challenge.
But courts have said that it's not ripe. Even before this court decided the Bray v. Russell case and Woods v. Tell, which dealt with the former bad time statute and post-release control, court said until you are subject to application of that statute, it's not your constitutional claims are not yet ripe for review. And right now, he hasn't served his minimum term. He might never completely serve his minimum term or be subject to this hearing by ODRC.
But that's an as-applied challenge. What about a facial challenge?
I think there is an argument that this is a facial challenge, but again, it's two or three specific divisions of Revised Code 2967.271 that are the core concerns here. And those just don't apply. They can't even, ODRC can't even take any action until the minimum term has been served. And there are so many things that could happen that hearing won't ever take place, that it's just too early to address these concerns now.
But isn't if you look at the statutory scheme on post-release control, it's required based on certain types of crimes. Even the permissive is required on certain types of crimes. But in this case, so it's related to the actual crime. In this case, the extended sentence is related to something that's not adjudged by a court, that's not under the criminal code based on a particular crime. It's based upon the judgment of officials in the prison system. Am I correct?
Correct, it is. And that goes to the merits of these constitutional arguments, which is, again, not why we're here. We're here to determine whether those claims are ripe for review.
But doesn't that go to the facial validity of the statute? And wouldn't that be ripe at any time?
I don't believe so, because the statute just hasn't taken effect yet. I understand it is a facial challenge, which can be considered, but if we don't know if he'll ever get to this point, it's just too early to even address the issue.
And why doesn't he have standing? That's what you're arguing. Why does he not have standing?
Because the statute doesn't apply until he served his minimum term.
But he's advised of it at sentencing, right? So doesn't it apply?
He's advised that it will apply to him at some point, but it hasn't taken it. It doesn't apply yet.
But then it can't be imposed on him if it's not advised at the time of his sentence. Am I correct? Just like post-release control?
Exactly. There are certain things that it has to be imposed at the sentencing hearing. And if he serves the minimum term, and if ODRC decides to keep him past that term, then he can raise these constitutional arguments. I see I'm running into my colleague's time, so if there are no further questions, I would just ask that the decision below be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Bry, colleagues saved you about 3 minutes. If you unmute yourself, we'll hear you.
I apologize for that. Thank you. Chief Justice and Justices, may it please the court. I want to address a couple of the points that have come up here. One is about the question about post-release control. Of course, that's been built into felony sentencing for such a time that for a serious felony, you know it's part of the sentence. And we need to remember, too, that because this court in Woods v. Taub decided the constitutional challenge to the post-release control 21 years ago, which was in the context of a habeas case, the appeals that we get today in post-release control tend to be more about the advisement. So it's really actually the Woods case and Bray v. Russell in terms of the mode of action is more similar, because those were extraordinary writ cases where the court did address a constitutional claim that is more similar to this one. The ripeness pertains to the court's jurisdiction and ensures that the court will not issue advisory opinions or answer hypothetical questions. And that's important in any case to preserve that and answer that question correctly, which is why we say that this is not a ripe case, because although the defendant says that he's challenging the whole sentence, what he's really complaining about is DRC's execution of the sentence potentially at some point into the sentence so that he might get more than the presumed minimum term. The presumed minimum term is, that gives him an expectation in a way that's a little different than the old indefinite sentencing scheme that we had before 1996, that nobody thought that DRC's or the parole board's involvement in it presented a constitutional problem to decide when somebody should be released. Here it's a similar scheme, except that the presumption is changed.
Isn't ripeness a judicial creation? And if it is it based in any particular section of the Constitution?
Your Honor, it's a doctrine that the courts have enunciated, but it is based on jurisdiction because it's important for courts to avoid issuing advisory opinions. That is a jurisdictional concern. And so that gets at the court's jurisdiction to address actual cases that are coming before it and not abstract questions, such as some of the cases we've cited at page 8 of our brief. State against Loving was one of them. Another example where this court declined to reach a constitutional issue was a state v. DH, a juvenile case. So there are other times when the court has looked at these issues and decided that notwithstanding somebody bringing it in an appeal, that was not the correct time.
But is there anything in the Ohio Constitution? Because, I mean, our jurisdiction, as well as the jurisdiction of the lower courts of the state, are established by the Constitution, but ours is a bit different from the appellate and the common pleas courts, whose jurisdiction is then extended as established by the legislature. For the Ohio Supreme Court, our jurisdiction is established squarely in the Ohio Constitution. Is there something that would prevent us from looking at that issue?
Your Honor, it's that the ripeness doctrine does have the jurisdictional component, as we've discussed, in terms of addressing actual cases and the courts. And I apologize, I don't have the court's jurisdictional constitutional provision in front of me, but there is still that tie to actual cases that makes the ripeness doctrine pertinent here. And in conclusion, we think that the case is that the challenge that this defendant is making to his sentence, which has to do with, will he be allowed to be released at some point after his minimum term, that is not yet ripe. We understand that if the court disagrees with that, as we said in our brief, we would simply ask that the court then remand this case to the Sixth District and take a case where the merits issues have been preserved so that they can be fully briefed. But again, we believe this is case is not yet ripe. This claim is not yet ripe for decision.
All right, thank you.
Thank you very much.
All right, counsel, you have reserved about 4.5 minutes, it looks. Counsel.
Sorry about that. This case has stayed merits cases pending outcome of this case. So we do agree that this case should be remanded to the Sixth District for determination on the merits. And if that happens, what I would do is I would just petition the Sixth District to stay the case pending this court's decision in the state merits cases. But the state and the Attorney General really haven't answered the question of when has a doctrine of judicial restraint ever been invoked to create piecemeal constitutional litigation where the right to counsel would not apply. And there's no answer that counsel might be appointed. The problem is that the right just simply does not apply. We could not find any case like this. And also I keep hearing the state and the attorney, assistant attorney general argue that we're not challenging the indefinite sentence. Yes, we are challenging the indefinite sentence. We are saying that the minimum penalty statute and the maximum penalty statute are themselves invalid. And it was error for the trial court to impose sentence under those statutes. That's not a hypothetical or advisory or abstract issue. In a common pleas court, when a defendant is about to be sentenced and the defense counsel says, judge, we believe that imposing sentence under the indefinite sentencing scheme is unconstitutional, and therefore we want you to sentence under the indefinite sentencing scheme. And the prosecutor says, no, we believe it is constitutional for thus and such reason. That is a hot contest, hot controversy. That gives standing and that gives ripeness. I want to just, I'm not saying the general, I want to use a hypothetical to illustrate something about what the state is arguing. The state wants this court to adapt a bright line test that anytime that there's an indefinite sentencing scheme, that the defendant can't do anything about it, can't have a lawyer. They have to file a separate civil lawsuit, and they can only do that after they're already in prison. So let's just change the scheme a little bit. Let's say that the definite sentencing scheme exists, the same Tokes law is passed, but there's a provision at the end that says the indefinite sentencing scheme only applies to minority defendants. And there's two co-defendants, a white man and an African-American man. And they both go to sentencing in the same case. And the judge gives the first defendant 4 years, and then the African-American defendant is up, and the judge says, well, I give you 4 to 6 years. And that man says, well, wait a minute, this is unconstitutional. No judge, the Ohio Attorney General and the Lucas County Prosecutor's Office wouldn't argue that, oh, that person has to wait and see whether the prison department will hold them over beyond 4 years or not before they can challenge this. Obviously, that would be challengeable at the trial court level. And so I'm not saying the General Assembly would pass a law like that, but the very fact that the state's...
But wouldn't the difference is what would be challengeable there is the difference in how the opponents were treated based on race?
That would be a facial attack, too. It'd just be, it wouldn't be a different in kind. It's still a facial constitutional attack. It's just a difference in degree. And we're saying, Maddox is saying, my constitutional rights were violated, just like the man in my hypothetical. In fact, what we're saying is everyone's constitutional rights is being violated by the statutory scheme. So it's clearly a ripe issue. And to say, and back to Chief Justice O'Connor, asked the prosecutor, well, what is the remedy? What if this is ultimately found to be invalid? And the state says, well, he can file a lawsuit for some money. You cannot quantify a man's or a woman's freedom in that way. That goes directly to the hardship issue that we were talking about. Even if the ripeness doctrine might otherwise apply here, courts will not employ the doctrine when it works hardship, particularly when the issue is otherwise fit for judicial review. Here it's fit because whether this statutory scheme as a whole, we're not saying view in isolation, as a whole is invalid, needs no further developed record 4 years from now. We ask you to reverse and remand. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, counsel. We will take the matter under advisement. You're going to be notified of our decision. Marshall, please adjourn court.
Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. This open session of the Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio now stands adjourned.